Good. I'd like to back up to where we left off. You know, I think one way of looking at all of this is that clearly Thomas Merton is not offering us a method. He really isn't offering us an answer to anything. But rather, he speaks from his heart in ways that goes right to our heart, in helping us become more aware of our own stirrings and our own longings for a more abiding awareness of God's oneness with us in life itself. And we're so far, we're looking at this in terms of a process of the lifelong process of stabilizing in psychological spiritual maturity as we go through life, through daily life and prayer and so on. And now we're getting to the place where he guides us in what is more of a mystical dimension of this, which is a state of unitive consciousness, of a sense of an unexplainable oneness, an all-pervasive oneness, that we, God, others, and all things are unexplainably one. And we're starting there. So are we kind of together? Good. And so... by lunch, we have to reach mystical union. we'll do our best, see what we can do. Okay, here we go. We have to get at this poetically, so by alluding to it, you can recognize the innuendo, so what's being alluded to. And at this point, I would like to, about the mystic, although I'm not God, I'm not other than God either, and so on. I'd like to refer to another way of trying to get clear about the mystic, mystical, contemplative, mystical spirituality. And I'd like to draw on this from the reflections that I did with Richard Rohr on following the mystics to the narrow gate, and use this as the metaphor. Imagine you're living this way, the way we're talking here, more or less. More or less. And you must be living it more or less, for you and have been drawn to come here. So you're in via, you're on the way. And you're grateful for it. You are grateful for it. And you come to this place of kind of gratitude and intimacy and mystery and all of that. And you come to this place and you're sitting there in prayer, like your daily quiet time. And in all this, then, I'll be God. I'm going to be God talking to you. Isn't this wonderful how you and I are becoming so one with each other, really? I've always been one with you, but you've not nearly been so one with me. And I hope this is as good for you as it is for me. Because I think this is great, really. Because I think you're amazing, really. Kind of pretty extraordinary. Quite taken by you. And but I'd like you to notice something. That up till now, this is you and I being one with each other on your terms. Now, I know it's on my terms in the sense that you believe in me and you want to do my will, and I appreciate that. Really, it means the world to me, really. It touches me. It gets to me. You win me over every day. But I do want to let you know, though, that very, very soon now, you'll be dead. And it won't be like this. See, it won't be like this. Because through all eternity, See, now it's on my terms. You want to do my will. But notice it's on my terms, on your terms. That is, you find me in your belief, you find me in your convictions, you find me in your struggles, you find me in your hopes, and it's wonderful. But when you're dead, it won't be like this. Because then for all eternity, we won't be one with each other on your terms, we'll be one with each other on my terms, on infinite terms. And I can hardly wait to see the look of surprise on your face. This great surprise party goes on forever. You don't have a clue, really. Really. You know, when you first show up in heaven, you got that look on your face, a lot of flash, angels taking pictures. And it's just because the infinite love that is the architect of our hearts has made our hearts in such a way that nothing less than an infinite union with infinite love will be enough for us. See? So it's only in eternity, see, will be the consummation of your heart's desire, which is the consummation of my desire for you, which is myself. See? And this is eternal glory. So now as in a mirror darkly, day by day. And when death comes, we're not annihilated, but consummated. And it's homecoming. And now I'd like to make you an offer. And I want to let you know that there's no obligation to accept this offer. That is, if you turn it down, I will not in any way be offended or hurt. And it will not diminish this deepening union with each other on your terms. But the offer is this: how would you like to not have to wait until you're dead to be one with each other on my terms? See. And before you answer, I owe it to you to know that there's two conditions that need to be met for this to occur. One, you have to let go of or die to the last trace of depending on anything less than an infinite union with the infinity of me as the sole source of your identity and security. Like that. See, John of the Cross says, a bird held by a slender thread is just as much a prisoner as one held by a great rope if it will not break that thread. See? So as long as there's anything other, than an infinite union with the infinity of me as the sole source of your security and identity, this oneness with each other on my terms cannot occur. The second thing I need to let you know is that you're not going to be able to do this. It's impossible. No one's ever been able to do this, really. You know, and therefore, I'll help you by seeing to it that it's impossible for you to function on your own terms. See, you can count on me to see to it that you're living in the middle of an unworkable situation. I will not let you down. And so it's a deal. See, it's up to you. What do you think? Do you want to give it a try? And you go like this. I'll get back to you. And God says, look, I get it. Seriously. No, I really, really get it. No offense taken. Really. See, it's kind of like this. See, what will become of me if I say yes to this? But the deeper question is, what will become of me if I don't? See, the price paid for the half-lived life is bitter. And there's the imperative of your awakened heart, of the need to surrender to what you're incapable of achieving. And this is the path. It's the path. And God says, now I have another encouraging word. Remember the time that you turned to see the flock of birds descending. Remember when you held the little baby, it had your little finger like this. Remember when you knew love in your own heart. You heard the splash of the frog, you didn't know it was there. That was me. That was me. And you were momentarily living on my terms. Isn't that great? See? So you've already had a taste, see, of the oneness that's beyond your abilities to achieve. And furthermore, I have placed within your heart a certain restless longing for more daily abiding oneness that has been so fleetingly glimpsed, which, by the way, has brought you right up to this very moment with me. Really. Now, this moment that I'm now, no, I'm not God, and I'm just Jim Finley again, okay. It's hard to tell the difference, I know. What can I say? And by the way, look. This happens to people. But Thomas Merton, I think, tries to help us put words to something so intimate and all-encompassing we don't recognize it. We don't recognize it. Particularly if it's welling up out of the intricacy of very messy things. See, we don't know that it's happening to us. That the art of contemplative discernment is the art of pausing to carefully take in what's happening to you. See? No. And how can I learn to live in obediential fidelity to what's happening to me? Like that. And this is Thomas Merton now offering trustworthy guidance for the person called on this path. Does this make sense so far? It does. To me, it does. Makes sense. And I want to share with you an example of this. It helps, and how this happened to me with Merton, because sometimes, like a recovery meeting, it helps to share our stories of, what is it, recovery, strength, and hope? What are they, that was? Experience, strength, and hope, yes. Hello, my name is Jim, I'm a recovering mystic. Hi, Jim. I also suffer from grandiose delusions, if you don't know. I go off my meds and these talks come out. Let me tell you, because I want to show, see, this is where it happens one-on-one. It happens really in spiritual direction, because it happens to each person as it happens, like this. You know, I shared that I grew up in this home with all this, it was physical, sexual, emotional abuse. It was just a nightmare, actually. And I read Merton when I was 14. Just got to me. And read him every day and aspired to go to the monastery. And when I graduated from high school, Hoban High School in Akron, my father knew nothing about this. He was very anti-Catholic and so on. And he was out trimming the hedges. So I went out and I told him I wanted to know if I could go be a monk. And he wanted to know what a monk was. And I explained it as best I could, my voice shaking. And he said to me, this is typical, you know, he said, if you go to that place, he said, I'll murder your mother to punish you. He said, I'm not kidding, I'll kill her if you go there. And I left the next day. Took a Greyhound bus and went to the monastery. And when I got there, I had to be interviewed by 3 monks, one of whom was John Hughes Bamberger, who was a psychiatrist. to be sure you had mental status to get in. And he asked, oh, what do your parents think of you coming here? I said, they've been praying for it for years. Because I thought if I told them about the trauma, they wouldn't let me in. You know what I mean? And I thought I deserved to try it. I deserved to try it. So I said, you know. And so I walked in this more wounded than I realized. It had this profound effect on me. Really, I can't explain that really, just really. And the first time I went in to see Merton, because of the trauma, I had issues with authority figures. And so when I would sit down to talk with him, my voice would shake. You know, I would shake like this. I had hyperventilate, like I couldn't get my breath. And he asked me, what's wrong? I know what was going on. And I said, shaking, I said, I'm scared because you're Thomas Merton. And that, maybe this influenced me to be a therapist years later. This was a brilliant intervention. I worked at the pig barn at the time. He said, under obedience, I want you to come in here every day after work before Vespers and talk to me about the pigs every day. And I remember thinking, I can handle that. And I went in and we talked about the pig. And he'd listen to all this. How's sow number five? How's her foot? And all of that. And it leveled the playing field for me. And I honestly think for all that I've read about Merton and reflected on, nothing went so deep for me as when we sat together talking about the pigs. Because we sat there as equals, see, as two broken people whom God loves, like this. And I told him about the experience in the sign of Jonas when I read the sign of Jonas and how I'd long for this experience. And he told me, he said, once in a while you'll find somebody with whom you can speak of such things. He said, but they're hard to find. He said, they either don't know about it or they'll give you reasons why you can postpone it. And he talked about the willingness to be radical in this heartfelt desire to give yourself unexplainably to the infinite love that unexplainably gives itself to you, breath by breath by breath by breath, and be completely transformed in it as life. And I did that. I just gave myself to that. And I think this is really Thomas Merton. I think this is really the essence of Thomas Merton. It's this kind of vulnerable, radical sincerity in opening ourselves and letting this love have its way with us, as precious in our fragility. It's the essence of everything, I think. And so now the question then is, well then how does this affect prayer? Because before, the way we were talking before the break, prayer is a reflective process, remember? Lord God, I have no idea where I'm going, I do not see the road ahead of me, and so on. And one engages in this loving exchange with God through scripture and readings and liturgy and so on. That's how we grow. That's how we grow. But now, when one has come to this point, then what becomes of prayer? See, what is prayer like when you've come to a oneness that has no words? See, then how does one pray? So here's Thomas Merton. This is New Seeds of this is Merton's Palace of Nowhere, page 128. Merton was a priest at the monastery, and this is right before the Second Vatican Council. And so I don't know how many monks are there at the time, maybe 200 monks, maybe 80 of them are priests. And so each priest would say Mass at the same time in a little altar with one of the lay brothers as a server of the Mass. So all these Masses were going on. It's kind of great in a way, it was good. And Merton would say Mass in the novitiate chapel because he was novice master. And it was a tiny little chapel. And he's sitting there after Mass, and this is his prayer. And here he's modeling for us contemplative prayer. Beauty of sunlight falling on a tall vase of red and white carnations and green leaves on the altar of the novitiate chapel. The light and dark, the darkness of the fresh crinkled flower, light, warm, and red all around the darkness. The flower is the same color as blood, but it is in no sense whatever as red as blood, not at all. It is as red as a carnation, only that. This flower, this light, this moment, this silence, God is. Eternity. He passes, he remains. We pass in and out. He passes, we remain. We are nothing, we are everything. He is gone from us. He is not here, we are here in him. All these things can be said, but why say them? The flower is itself, the light is itself, the silence is itself, I am myself. All perhaps illusion, but no matter, for illusion is the shadow of reality, and reality is the grace and gift that underlies all these lights, these colors, this silence. Underlies, is that true? They are simply real. They themselves are his gift. Next quote. Although I see the stars, I no longer pretend to know them. Although I have walked in those woods, how can I claim to love them? One by one, I shall forget the names of individual things. You who sleep in my breast are not met with words, but in the emergence of life within life and of wisdom within wisdom. You are found in communion, thou and me and I and thee and thou and them and they and me, dispossession within dispossession. I'd like to reflect on this text. See, let's say, bring this down to like experience, like how this sheds light on our actual experience of this. Let's say we're living our life day by day, and then from time to time, we're graced with one of these fleeting flashes of resting in God, resting in us. The turning to see the flock of birds descending in the arms of the beloved, the child, the dying person, the friend, the poem, the prayer. From time to time, we're graced with this. See? And then it dissipates. And when it dissipates, three things tend to happen when it dissipates. We either come back to all of this as if nothing has happened. Scripture talks about a man who looks in the mirror and walks away forgetting what he looks like. Is the gate of heaven flew open and you walk right past it like nothing ever happened. See, you got a cell phone call. You're not finished complaining about your latest complaint and so on. Another thing can start to happen is these touches can illumine your heart and render everything translucent to God. In other words, in the beginning, everything is opaque to God, but everything glows with a gentle light. The accumulative effect of these fleeting flashes of oneness can render an underlying sensitivity to a certain kind of translucent quality to the concreteness of things. The sound of the friend's voice, the taste of bread, the slant of light across the floor. One is sensitized to this. And the third thing that can happen is a great longing opening up in your heart. That have, in my most childlike hour, I fleetingly tasted that without which my life is forever incomplete. And what am I to do with this? See? Because the thing about these wonderful moments of oneness is we can't make them happen. If you've noticed, you can't go out and generate another unit of moment. I mean, you can. But there's contrived ways and they short circuit on you. But when they're authentic, we cannot make them happen. But here's the key to contemplative practice. Although we cannot make the moments of unitive experience happen, we can assume the inner stance that offers the least resistance to be overtaken by what we cannot attain. Lovers cannot make their moments of oceanic oneness happen, but together they can assume the stance that offers the least resistance to be overtaken one more time by the gift of oceanic oneness that gives meaning to everything they do in their life together. The poet cannot make poetry happen, but the poet can assume the stance that offers the least resistance to be overtaken by the gift of poetry. Those committed to healing cannot make healing happen, but those committed to healing can assume the stance that offers the least resistance to the gift of healing occurring. The addict who's seeking sobriety cannot make sobriety happen, but the person can assume the stance that offers the least resistance to the gift of sobriety being granted. And this is the stance. And so the art form of contemplative prayer is the art form that offers the least resistance, see, to be overtaken one more time. And in this text about the flowers of looking at the carnations, he gives us a feel for practice. And I'd like to reflect on this for a bit. Notice in the passage about the carnations that we just read, notice Thomas Merton is not achieving anything. He's not producing anything. It's not productive. You know, it's very un-American in a way. And considering how busy we are, we wonder why he wasted our busy life reading about looking at carnations. But this is a moment of non-action. And a moment of non-action bears witness to a life of the claustrophobic nature of a life based on productive effort. Thomas Merton once said, some people never see a tree until they're ready to saw it down. The only way they see a tree is in terms of lumber yield. And the only way they see themselves as a functionary, someone who's serving a function, hence the fear of growing old, the fear of becoming sick, the fear of being disenfranchised, see, the fear of not being able to perform the function that one assumes is one's identity and sense of self-worth. But notice he's not achieving anything. It's kind of a non-action like this. Also notice in this that Merton isn't thinking of anything. Notice he says the carnations are not as red as blood, in quotes, not at all. They are as red as a carnation, only that. Because if it was red as blood, that would be comparative thinking, drawing analogies through concepts. And before you notice, you're sitting there in silent prayer, you're not even praying, you're writing a little essay on the analogous nature of the color red in all red things, and you're off and running again. You spun out, and your thinking self and all that it thinks has carried you off. See? So he says, red as a carnation, only that. Only that. This flower, this light, this moment, God is. And I'd like to share something about this, which is important, I think. A lot of times, the reason I think we have difficulty with this is we quit just when we're getting started because we don't think anything is happening. And I want to give an example of this. Let's say, I want to use an example of gardening, say going out into the garden, but it could be an intimate conversation with the beloved, or it could be a therapy hour. You know, it could be working with watercolors or poetry, it could be whatever it is, but let's say I want to use nature in a garden. You go out to your garden, and you say you're going to spend several hours in the garden. Isn't this true? Isn't this true? The level of consciousness at which you went into the garden begins to yield and give way to a qualitatively deeper, more interior experience that grants access to qualitatively deeper, more interior experience of the miracle of being one with the earth. Isn't that true? It's true. My wife and I were very fortunate. We live in the ocean, right at the ocean in Marina Del Rey. And we've been living there now for 23 years, I think. When I get out in the get up in the morning and go out and take a look, I don't do this. I don't go, you know, same old ocean. You know, there's nothing more boring than the horizon at the ocean. You know that straight line? It's completely uninteresting. Completely uninteresting. See? But when you sit with it for a long, long time, it has its way with you. Really. And the busyness falls away. And the level of consciousness at which you sat down in the midst of your ruminations begins to yield to a qualitatively deeper, more interior experience that grants access to qualitatively deeper, more interior dimensions of the miracle of the ocean. And you know you're looking at God's body. See? And you'd linger about the scene. You know, no matter how long you sat there, you would never exhaust what's being given to you there. And that's the contemplative experience. Two people who love each other very much, and he says, I love you. She doesn't say to him, you know, you said that yesterday. And the day before that, you're so redundant, honest to God. Boring. I want to hear something new out of you. I mean it, really. See, he doesn't say, I love you. And she goes, really? I didn't. Let me write that down. Have any books on that? Gee whiz, thanks for the tip. See? Why do they say it over and over again? Because every time they say it, they recreate the possibility of discovering one more time the love that words cannot be found that are adequate to express it. It's kind of a liturgy of the word with each other, and this is practice. A practice is any act habitually entered into with your whole heart that takes you to the deeper place is practice. And you have to stay there long enough to let this transformative, subtle descent happen to you and get regrounded in it, like homecoming, like a deep, deep homecoming, like this. Text from Merton. See, this sounds kind of appealing, but it isn't as if we're all going to rush home and try it. Here's what I share with people sometimes, sharing all this. Let's imagine you hear about all this. You get really enthused about it. And you go home, you decide at the corner of your room in your home where you're going to meditate every day with all your heart to have the big breakthrough. And you get floor-to-ceiling bookshelves, mahogany bookshelves, and get the complete works of all the mystics bound in leather with a little red ribbon in each one. It costs a fortune, but it's worth it, really. You get candles, lots and lots of candles, incense, a lot of incense, special blend from the Vatican and the Taj Mahal, holy water from Lourdes and Mortigorsky, wherever, and you get a gong, you get one of these. They say once you get one of these, there's no turning back. You get a prayer cushion. You get a prayer cushion. You get the deluxe model, has a seatbelt on it, so when you take off, and you go to the room, your heart pounding with anticipation. You light all your candles. You light your incense. You sit on your cushion. You fasten your seatbelt. You open your and wrap around sound a Gregorian chant on Bose stereo. You dim the lights, like a lot of icons and pictures like this. You ring your gong. You brace yourself and can't get the damn thing off the ground. Going to take your bill back for a refund. Thomas Merton once said, we all came here with such high hopes and we're all walking around disgruntled because once you get in here, you discover half the people in here are crazy. Which is true. He said, but then you see one of these old lay brothers coming towards you down the cloister like a transparent child. And you know he found what you came here looking for. See, this is what Merton says. We're all trying to work out a deal with God. You know, I'm really, really serious about this mystical union with you business. Really, really. Under one condition. That when I cross the finish line into mystical union, my ego will remain intact. I'll become a mystical ego and finally get the respect I deserve. So here's a quote from Merton. Jeez, okay. See, here's the catch. Here's the catch. See, why don't we all go home and do this? Here's the catch. God, my God, God whom I meet in darkness, with you it is always the same thing, always the same question that nobody knows how to answer. I have prayed to you in the daytime with thoughts and reason, and in the nighttime you have confronted me, scattering thought and reason. I've come to you in the morning with light and with desire, and you have descended upon me with great gentleness, with most forbearing silence, in this inexplicable night, dispersing light, defeating all desire. I have explained to you 100 times my motives for entering the monastery, and you have listened and said nothing, and I have turned away and wept with shame. Let no one hope to find in contemplation an escape from conflict, from anguish, or from doubt. On the contrary, the deep and inexpressible certitude of the contemplative experience awakens a tragic anguish and opens many questions in the depths of the heart, like wounds that cannot stop bleeding. I'd like to reflect on these two cheerful quotes. See, you start out, but in life like this, really, so much of life is like this, really. When you really get into the trenches of things like this. See, that my God, with you, whom I meet in darkness, with you it is always the same thing, always the same question that nobody knows how to answer. See, in the beginning, there are many questions. Beginners have many questions. And that's why they think they're looking for someone who has the answer. I think we're all holding out that someday we'll run into someone who's not confused. And we can say, do you have a minute? See, I'd like to talk. And so we read a lot of books. We think we're looking for the answer for our question. But what the text suggests is this. What if all along, what if it's not you asking the question? God's the one asking the question. And you don't know the answer to God's question. As a matter of fact, you don't even understand the question. Imagine you've been invited, you think, to a university to give a lecture on the spiritual life. And when you enter this big room, you're pleased to see how many people have signed up for your lecture. And you go up to the stage and you're getting out your notes and pinning on your microphone and getting things ready. And an administrator comes up with someone and says to you as gently as possible, there's been a terrible misunderstanding. You weren't invited to give the lecture. You were invited to listen to it. You know, as a course. As a course, this is a graded course. And the teacher of the course is waiting for you to get out of her way to set up the notes. So in front of the whole room, you're fumbling around trying to get your microphone off. And so on, the only seat left is in the back of the room. And when the professor begins to speak, the person speaks in a language that you don't know. And the first exam's on Friday. We don't like moments like this. We thought we were teaching the course. And all along, we were being asked to take it. See? And I think this is why. This is not so popular, see. You know, it's the willing to come to the end of your possibilities and then not running away and waiting with complete dependency on God, see, to grant. We cannot attain it, but it attains itself in us and our inability to attain it. See, that's the amazing grace. We cannot attain it, but it attains us. In our inability to attain it. Amazing grace like this. And therefore I'd like to share an image of this, if this helps. You can either try this literally or just take it poetically to make a point about Thomas Merton and the spiritual life. Imagine, this is the practice. Go to your room an hour before sunset and let your only agenda be to be with God while it gets dark. That's your only agenda, is to be with God while it gets dark. Go there for any other reason, you may or may not succeed. If you go to your room to fall asleep, you may have insomnia. If you go to your room to figure something out, maybe you won't be able to. But if you go to your room with no intention but to be with God while it gets dark, you can't go wrong. Now, God's been with you now every night since the day you were born. And this is the first time you decided to join God there. And God's so excited to see you coming, really. Like, what am I, chop liver? Where you been, really? Close the door, take off your shoes, sit on the floor, and lean back against a wall facing an open window. Put your head back against the wall and sit there like that for one full hour after it's completely dark. Don't put on how to be with God while it gets dark mood music. Don't take with you your copy of How to Be with God While It Gets Dark and Five Easy Lessons. Don't run away in your mind, see, with grocery lists. Don't escape the unrelenting sovereignty of day's end. No one slows it down and nobody speeds it up. It is primordial. It is primordial, like this. Lean your head back and stay there. If you start to fall asleep, sit a little straighter, because this is important. This is important. And sit there like an unlearned child with all your heart, just as you are, for one full hour after it's completely dark. Your ego's off on the side saying, "What in the hell are you doing? Who's tending the store? You know, I don't get it. This, I can't. I won't tolerate this." And after one full hour is completely dark, your legs hurt, your rear end hurt, your back hurts, your head hurts. You've been bored 10,000 times. See, but you were firm in your resolve, like the Buddha sitting all night beneath the Bodhi tree. See. To understand the arising of suffering, the source of liberation from suffering. And look around the room. Look around. This might be the room you've fallen asleep in every night for many years. And this is the first time you've been present to your own room like this. The shadowy outline of things. You know, your shoes on the floor by the door, the coffee cup with the teaspoon in it. The arrangement of things like a kind of a quiet mandala of things just the way they are. This image I'm about to share now, I think I got this from my aunt, Sister Lucille, who lived here in Cleveland, Incarnate Word Sister in Parma. She was dying when she was 9 years old, I think of diphtheria, I think it was. And there was an injection, whatever it was, and but she was in this kind of delirious state. And she saw a field of flowers. And the flowers were fluorescent. They were lit up. And they knew her. And they were calling her, "Lucille, Lucille, Lucille." And she was running through the flowers, laughing like this. And the doctor, and she, it brought her back. See? And she said later she knew that influenced her decision to enter the convent. Because she saw the convent as a place where one can learn to open one's heart. That I think this is where this image comes from. Imagine it's the middle of the night, you're all alone, you're dying, and you know that you're dying. You turn and you look at the flowers on the windowsill, silhouetted in the moonlight. They seem to know all about it. They seem to know all about it. We fear it so. We fear it so. But we long for it. Like this unnameable, intimate immediacy of the gift of things, just like this. Slowly stand up, and without turning on any lights, take off all your clothes and get into bed and go to sleep. Not a bad way to end the day, I'd say. It's that easy and that hard to do. because we're not inclined to do it. See? And what happens to us sometimes is life does it to us. Recovery can do it. The struggle for sobriety. What does it mean to really turn to one's higher power? Well, you're not going to make it. You are not going to make it, and you've just slipped for the 10th time. What does it mean when the relationship you thought would never end is unraveling before your very eyes? Like this, what's it mean? See, what do you do? What does it mean when there's something so beautiful coming right towards you and you cannot hold on to your wounded sense of yourself and open your arms wide to what's coming your way? You can't hold on to your shame-based sense of self and accept what it is that's coming right at you. What do you do? Thomas Merton once said we should all get down on our knees right now and thank God we can't live the way we want to. God doesn't let us get away with it. See? And so really, I think Merton is inviting us to step into the stream of the inexplicable richness of our own unfolding life and not to addictively numb it, run from it, play games with it, but lean into it and keep our heart wide open and let God have our way with us, you know, in the midst of our life just as we are, just like this. I'll share a story. When I was writing Merton's Palace of Nowhere, I was at St. Christopher's in Rocky River. And I got up every morning at about 4:30 and put on Chopin's Nocturnes, and I wrote this book out longhand. And I really struggled with it because I hadn't written anything before. I didn't know if I could do it or should do it. It was kind of like that. And while I was struggling whether I could write this book or not, I had a dream. I had a dream, and this was the dream I had. I had a dream that I was invited to a large university to give a lecture on Thomas Merton's principles of folk dancing. And I think it came from his interest in Shaker art. He was very interested in the Shakers, you know, the simplicity of their furniture and so on. And so I came, there was a large hall, a packed auditorium, wood paneled walls, no windows. And I was formally introduced, and I'm very introverted. I don't like speaking in public. I get nervous. I don't like doing it, so I'd never done it. So I had my formal paper, and I was standing there. My knees were shaking, and I was reading Thomas Merton's Principles of Folk Dancing. And right as I was into the first two or three pages, someone turned out all the lights. So it was pitch dark, except for the little light on the podium, lectern shining on my notes. But I kept reading Thomas Merton's Principles of Folk Dancing. And then Thomas Merton appeared in the stage right off to the side of my lectern. And he was glowing. He was lit up. And he had his arms folded on his chest like this. He had a big grin on his face. And I could saw him out of the corner of my eye. And in my dream, the thought was, what are you doing here? You're dead. But I thought I dared not look up for my notes because I was so nervous I'd lose my place and, you know, I'd be too embarrassed to go on. And then Thomas Merton started to do a folk dance. See? And he had this big grin on his face, folk dancing. And I was nervously reading, and I was going, you're ruining my paper on your principles of folk dancing. And then someone in the first row, I could see the outline of the first row, someone stood up and started folk dancing with Merton. Another person stood, and at the end of the dream, everyone in the whole room was folk dancing with Thomas Merton, except for me, because I was reading his principles of folk dancing. Damn it. Will the world cooperate with my agenda? I worked hard on this paper. See. And I think that's the spirituality of Thomas Merton. Really, it's the great unraveling of our hearts that liberates us and setting us free to what was always there and we couldn't see it. Let's stand and stretch. Okay, good. Let me see.